This is actually, most of you might not know, but some of you will know, my maiden talk on Friday. The big talks. Where the big shot usually gives the talk. I've sat on this seat before and give some sutta classes, but this is the big thing. So it's my first time doing this. And that is so weird because it feels like only yesterday that I put on the robes. And now I'm sitting here, being the head monk. But time flies. The reason I am here is because Ajahn Brahm is giving a retreat. Ajahn Brahmali, who is usually the second guy to give the talks, is overseas doing a conference. Other senior monks are sick or otherwise occupied, and then it came down to me. So I've become already quite senior monk, and as I said, that feels so weird because it feels like yesterday that I put on this robe. By the way, it is still the same robe that I ordained, that was my first robe as a novice monk. You can see by the patches that it's quite old already. It's now more than 8 years old now, 9 maybe, something like that. So eight years. I don't count time, but yeah, and they flew by. And I said it felt like yesterday that I ordained, and it did really feel like I ordained yesterday because we had the wonderful event of ordaining another novice monk yesterday. His name is Sivali, and it's always very special to see somebody ordaining, especially as a novice monk, because then they really leave behind the lay life, and we speak the intentions when we say the words, when we go forth, this is what we call it, go forth from the lay life into the bhikkhu's life. We speak our intentions for the ending of suffering, for the realization of nirvana. That's why we go forth. And when that monk, Sivali, when he spoke those words, he was still a lay person. What was his lay name again? Anura. Yeah, he spent most of his time in another monastery from the BSWA, so I didn't know him very well. That's why I had to ask the name, Anura. When he spoke those words, I was really touched because I was reminded of my own ordination. All those years back. And my own intentions to stay in the robes for the ending of suffering, for the realization of the highest peace. So I was really touched, and I even, can admit, I shed a few tears that night when he ordained. Because even during my own ordination, I really, really struggled to speak those words because they felt so true to me. So I was crying throughout my ordination those years back, and I couldn't speak the words properly. Also because they're in a funny language, we do the Pali language from the Buddha, so it's already difficult, and then you're emotional, and so I struggled, but I managed to say the words. Sabba dukkha nisarana nibbana sacchikaranataya, for escaping all the suffering and realization of the highest peace. And that is what we monks live our life for. But I would love to speak about that. Ajahn Brahm said, though, it's the first talk after the range retreat when the monks come out and the people haven't seen the monks for a while, so keep it light. So I'm not talking about suffering tonight. Earlier, me and Venerable had a little discussion about death, actually. Well, not tonight then. We have to keep it a little bit light. But who knows what my mind might bring up. But yeah, we just came out of the range retreat. I'm not sure if everybody knows what that is. Most of you will know. But the range retreat, it's called range because it's from the time of the Buddha. They had this rainy season in India where it always used to rain quite a lot. And in those rainy season, we spent as monks and the nuns as well in their own monastery. 3 months, we don't travel anywhere except when it's really, really necessary, like when you get sick and you need to go to the hospital or whatever. And we don't engage in too much work. We keep our lives as simple as possible, just to focus on our development of our minds and to stay together as a community. Nobody leaves the place during that time, unless they disrobe, of course, which means when they're no longer a monk. But nobody disrobed during this rains. Yay. Also not during last rains, I don't think so. I wasn't here for last rains. But all the monks stayed in the monastery. How many monks do you think we have in Bodhinyana right now? 23? 23? There are 23 fully ordained monks, but I think we have 28 monks in total, with including the novices, or 27, something like that. 27 and a half, 28 monks. We lose count because sometimes people ordain or they go to another monastery for a while. But 27 is inspiring to see so many people to devote their lives to something that's not always easy. It's always inspiring for me to see. And I hope it's also inspiring for you to see or to know that there's so many monks over there. That is one of the reasons why we come and give these talks. I know during the rains period, you also have lay people giving here talks. And the monks don't come here because our talks would be any better. I don't think so. I think lay people can give excellent talks as well. But I feel there is something about monks and nuns that inspires people despite of the words that they might say. Just the renunciation that is, or just the intention even of the renunciations that people like Venerable Serrato have, is already by itself inspiring. And I say that so that if this talk is really crappy, then at least I was here. I don't know what I'm saying. But yeah. And the range retreat is always a really peaceful time for us monks because we don't do much work, as I said. But then after the range retreat, we have the big days coming up. We do the Katina Day. The Katina Day is a day at the end of the range retreat where lots of people come to the monastery to celebrate that the range retreat is over. It's over, and then they come to celebrate it. They should celebrate it at the start. Yes, it's coming, and when it's over, then we're sad. No, we're not sad as monks. But sometimes I like, oh, the range retreat is over, now we're working again. And during the big day, it's called Katina because during that day, my English sometimes trips up a bit. We sew a robe, and it's called a Katina robe. That's why it's called Katina Day. A Katina robe is the whole Sangha is supposed to come together to sew one robe for a monk in one single day. And then we give that robe to the monk. And that is a tradition from the time of the Buddha. So, but nowadays, things are different than the time of the Buddha, because in the time of the Buddha, how did the sewing happen? I was already making the gesture earlier. It is like this. So everybody could help along. Everybody had their own needle and thread. Monks even had needle boxes back then because needles were much more expensive back then, of course. Now they're like, they cost nothing. But back then, if you had a needle, really take care of it. But everybody had their needle, so they all worked together on the rope. But nowadays, we've got these kind of needles. Of course, you press the pedal and it's much easier on the sewing machine. So not all the monks work together because not all the monks have a sewing machine. We share two sewing machines with all the monks. And actually, I brought one into service because it broke. But anyway, that's a random thing. But we use it a lot, so they break. But because of this, because we use the sewing machines to sew the katina robe, not all the monks can work on it, so it's always two monks who have to do the whole robe. And you can see, well, it has all these lines. It is not just a piece of cloth with a border. It has all these sections in it. I don't know if you can see from where you are sitting. This one is all patched up, but even the original starting robe is made out of sections. And the reason for that is that in the time of the Buddha, cloth was much more expensive than now. And so when you had it all cut up, it was of less value. You couldn't make it into other things anymore. So that's why we have all these pieces. So it takes a lot of work to sew the katina robe. Because if you're just with two people and you have to sew a whole robe, and it takes many hours to do. Now, why am I saying this? Not just to tell you what we do, I'm actually going to make a point here. Because during the last 2 weeks of our 3 months range retreat, I had my own private retreat, a retreat within a retreat. And the monk's life is already a retreat from the lay life, so it's a retreat within a retreat within a retreat. And then you meditate, which is like inside of your retreat, you retreat inside, well, whatever, you see where I'm going. It's the ultimate retreat, basically. And during that retreat, I had some nice meditation, but nearing the end, my mind started playing with me because I knew as soon as I get out of the retreat, then the monks come together for our two-weekly meeting where we chant all the rules and then we discuss things. And one of the things that will be brought up is who is gonna be sewing the katina rope this year. And I have done it already many times in the past. So my mind was, they're gonna ask me again. And if Ajahn Brahm asks me like this, then I'm gonna say no in this way. And if they somehow just look at me in the way like, are you gonna do it? Then I'm just gonna be like looking the other way. I don't wanna sew the robe. I did it so many times already. So there I sat meditating like that. Like, I'm gonna do all these things to not have to sew the robe. All these other lazy monks, they should do it for once. Why always I have to do it? And what does that do to your ultimate retreat? Ruins it. Ruins it. My meditation was not, you couldn't even call it meditation anymore. I was creating suffering. Because why? I was craving to not do something. I was wanting things to be my way. And you'll recognize this. You have sometimes have, I don't want to do this. Why do they always give me the jobs? And why does my partner not wash the dishes? And why do I always have to do it? These kind of thoughts. And I recognize it within myself. This is not helpful. This is desire to, and ill will even towards other monks because they are the lazy monks and I am the hardworking monk. That's the kind of thoughts. then I decided, when the issue comes up, who's gonna sew the Katina robe? I'm gonna volunteer. I'll do it. Without them asking me. And the moment I made that decision, peace inside my mind. Because I was no longer wishing for things to be one way or the other. And even not just peace inside my mind, joy inside my mind. Because I was volunteering to do something. I was actually practicing generosity. Practicing generosity just by the intention alone. You already recognize. It's a kind of a letting go of your own wishes. And you want to do something for somebody else. And even just the intention alone is already quite powerful, even without having actually sewn the robe. But it did so happen that I did sew the robe. Because I did volunteer. So me and Venerable Jayako, a lovely monk, we spent quite a few hours, 4 hours it took us. We were really, really fast, actually. And usually it takes much longer. But we, our experience, as I said, we are always the ones to do it. Oh, now I'm getting angry again. No. What was I saying? Yeah, so 4 hours it took us, and we did it. We made one. And we did it well as well. And I'm really happy because we got to offer it to Ajahn Brahmali, who is a monk who is very well respected. Many of you know him. All of you know him, probably, who are here. And he needed a new robe. We always usually sew the lower robe, the skirt, or the sabong. Sarong. Why? Because it's smaller. Otherwise, we would be there for much longer than 4 hours. And yeah, so now having done that, I can recall it and be so happy that I did it, despite my initial reluctance. And I want you all to take a moment to remember something that you may have done in the past out of your generosity. Can be something small. Just take a moment and really imagine what it was like back then. Bring up the scenario again and imagine doing it again. Whatever your thing was, you volunteered, helped the sick people, open the door for somebody. Doesn't matter, big or small things. They all come from the same place of generosity. How does it make you feel to think about that? It always makes you feel happy. Always. In 100% of the people, 100% of the time, if you really focus on the act of generosity, it creates happiness. And then don't start thinking about, this other person who made me do this. No. Focus on your own intentions. And these kind of acts, these generosity, these acts of generosity are so important in the development of our minds. I noticed right now myself that when I said we go on the range retreat for 3 months, and then usually people, or that it gets followed by, we go on 3 months range retreat to meditate. But notice that I said to develop ourselves. Because the Buddhist path is more than just meditation. Whatever we do in life can be part of the path. My sewing of that Katina robe was not meditation, but it was just as important as all the meditation I did in the range retreat. Because I actually developed my mind there by going against my own desires. I feel it's important to sometimes reflect on that, because meditation is super important in Buddhism and is super nice, and you get a lot of insight and wisdom from it. But don't undervalue other aspects of Buddhism. And I'm focusing now on generosity. Yeah, but there's also just kindness to people in general. Yeah. And other good things to do, like restraining from harming living beings. These kind of things. Yeah, the precepts, basically. These are super, super important things. They actually form a basis for our meditation as well. Because when I just asked you to remember some act of generosity that you did, that is actually an instruction by the Buddha, to a way to meditate as well. It tells us in the old text, the suttas, this is one of the ways to meditate, is to reflect upon our generosity. We often think meditation is focusing on the breath, or maybe metta, vipassana, what have you. But reflecting on generosity is also a way to meditate. Why is that so? Who felt some happiness when they reflected on their generosity? Just put your hands up if you did. I already said it is for 100% of the people 100% of the time. Yeah, it makes you happy. That's why it's good. That's why it's part of meditation. Because meditation, we become more happy, is the goal. Yeah, we don't meditate to suffer more. I don't think I've ever met anybody who meditate to suffer more. Have you? That would be an interesting person to meet. No, it's natural in our mind. Nobody wakes up in the morning and may I suffer the whole day as much as possible. Nobody thinks like that. We all want to be more happy and free from suffering. And so to reflect upon generosity is one way to create more happiness and move away from suffering. And to reflect upon it, you first have to do it. So that's why these physical acts of generosity are just as important as the mental act of meditation. And when I asked you to reflect upon something, I might as well share one of my generosity stories, because the funny thing is, often, you get just as much joy about seeing other people being generous or hearing about other people's generous stories than from your own. So I'm going to share a little story now that, not to show that how generous am I, but just to make you, hopefully more happy. Because five years back or so, last time I was able to fly, because we got COVID and stuff, and see my parents, I had a stopover in this airport in Dubai. And the airport was really full, so the planes couldn't all go to their docking gates or whatever, where this pathway locks up. I don't know these technical terms, but when you go into the plane and they have this thing lock up to it, the thing you walk through, what is that called?
Footbridge.
The bridge, yes, okay, the footbridge. So they didn't have enough, so we had to go up on the stairs into the plane. Some of you may have done it before. And I was walking there, and next to me was this Arabian man. We all had to carry not everybody had to carry their carry-on, because I had only my little ball. But that man, and a little tiny bag, but that man had his whole suitcase. And he was old, and I saw in the look in his eyes that he did not expect to be climbing the stairs. He expected the footbridge. and I saw it, and I tried to tell him, I can lift your suitcase, but he didn't speak English. So I gestured like, and he, yeah, he gave me the suitcase. And I carried the suitcase up the airplane, into the airplane. And I put it down on the floor for him. And honestly, I've never seen anybody so grateful. That man, he thanked me something like what they say, something with Allah, thanks for Allah or something in Arabic. And just the look in his eyes was like, wow, this person carried this suitcase for me. But it was just, it took me a minute to walk up the stairs, and I'm young, so I don't mind carrying a suitcase. It was nothing. The act was nothing. But just remembering it, wow, it makes me so happy. I don't know the man, never met him before, or after, I mean. But yeah, just these small acts can have a big ripple effect in our lives, because they create this happiness. So I suppose what I'm saying is, try to do more of those small acts if you can, even if they seem silly. Open a door for a monk, for a monk, because I was already thinking ahead, but open the door for anybody. Yeah, don't have to do it only for monks. But I was already thinking ahead, because in Bodhayana Monastery, we always open the door for Ajahn Brahm. And sometimes we forget. And Ajahn Brahm, he can open the door himself. But sometimes we don't see that he's coming. And then he just stands there in front of the door like this, looking in to give somebody the opportunity to open the door for him. It even creates him more inconvenience, because he has to stand outside. He could as well just open the door himself and sit down inside, but he waits there until somebody opens the door. So we can have the opportunity to do this small act of generosity, to just open the door. Yeah. Sorry, sometimes I just think about funny things. But but at the end of the range retreat, I spent my range retreat in my hut, which is actually, I don't want to go into that, but my hut is quite far away from the main monastery, so I don't join the other monks with our usual chanting after the lunch, so I go straight away back, so I have time enough to eat before noon. That's the short of it. And when I leave the hall, where we get the food to go back to my hut, very often somebody also opens the door for me, because I'm carrying my bowl. It's also convenient that somebody opens the door, so you don't drop your bowl or your bowl lid and stuff. And what I did one of the days, when somebody opened the door for me with really like a gesture, like, this is for you, I'm doing it with generosity for you. Then I went outside, and then they closed the door, and then I turn back around and knock on the door. And they open it again, and I go back inside, and we went back and forth a couple of times. Super silly, but you know, these kind of things, that is what monks also do. You know, we are not what you might think are serious. They are die-hard meditation. Now we do these kind of funny things because it lifts up the mind of people. Everybody laughs when you see something stupid like that. And I laughed when I did it. But I did it anyway. It had no use at all, except it did have a use, actually. Make people happy. And have them open the door 5 times in a row, so they have much generosity to reflect upon. Yeah. Who did it? Who was it again? It's a funny thing, I don't even remember who it was who opened the door. But it still makes me happy to think about that somebody opened the door. Anyway, yeah, these kind of reflections on generosity. So I've been practicing them for many years now. Generosity, not just as a monk, but also when a layperson, I was already a Buddhist since I was 15 years old or something. So I'm now 35, so 20 years old. 20 years I've been trying my best. Never perfect, but you try your best practicing generosity. But still your mind is sluggish. Your mind is very stubborn. Your mind doesn't learn quickly often. Unless you're like a super genius in the time of the Buddha who gets enlightened very easily, but those people are very rare nowadays. So many of us, our minds are just a bit more slow, including mine, because I just told you about how I practice generosity by sewing the katina rope. But only a couple of days later, after we sewed the rope, I again got in the same kind of mindset. Because we started doing the normal work again that we do outside of the range, like the construction and everything that needs to happen in a monastery, the cleaning. Well, we clean during the rains as well, don't worry, but we do a little bit more structured. All the monks join in. And I actually hurt my back at some point, so I asked, can I do some work that doesn't involve getting my back even more hurt? Like, for example, the sweeping was my hint to the work monk who shares out the work. Because the sweeping, that is the most desired job in the monastery. I don't know what field you work in, but there's probably one kind of job in that field which everybody wants to have. This maybe the CEO or I don't know. But in the monastery, that job is the sweeping. Yeah, if you really made it as a monk, then you are sweeping. That's what I feel like anyway. Because sweeping is nice and easy. It's very meditative. Probably if you have to do sweeping every day, then you don't think like this anymore. But this is what I feel like. Yeah, I want to do the sweeping because nice and meditative, nice and easy. It's just a few leaves. They sweep it every day, so it's not a lot of work. Just around the main buildings, just get a bit of the leaves off the road so it looks nice. So I said, I'll do the sweeping to the work monk when you share out the work. And then what happened? During the work meeting, I was like, fingers crossed, can I get the sweeping? That would be nice. And then the work monk said, okay, Sunyo and this other monk. I won't name names, but. No. You do the sweeping. I was like, yes. And then but he wasn't finished yet. He said, of the boundary roads. But the boundary roads never get swept. Not in years they've been swept. And they're full of rocks and fallen trees branches and all sorts of other stuff. So I was like, Sunyo do the sweeping of the boundary roads. I was really happy, and then I was like, why do I get the boundary roads? So I was uplifted, and then the same happened once when I went to the dentist. I hadn't been to the dentist for a long, long time, but we have a very generous supporter who is a dentist, Jake. He used to do the audio. And the first time I went to see Jake, I lie there, mouth open, and Jake went, look a bit around with his glass, with the mirror and stuff, and he said, I hadn't been for 10 years, so I was expecting a bad thing, but he said, that looks all very, the way it was, like, that looks all very, I was uplifted, and then, so he had to do some drilling. Anyway, I don't know, it doesn't really connect to the story very well, but the sweeping. So the sweeping, I was, this happens if you don't prepare. We shouldn't prepare, Arjun Brown said, so then you get this. But the sweeping, yeah. So I had to practice my generosity again, because I had to do something that I didn't want to do. I didn't want to sweep all those paths that hadn't been swept literally for years, and with all the super many twigs and even layers of dirt covering the whole thing, where you're just like, instead of what the other monks get to sweep, they get just a few leaves. I have to do, and I asked about my back, you know. I said I had a hurt back, and now I'm here pulling up the branches and then the rocks and stuff that the kangaroos kicked onto the road, and the trees that fell down. Why me? Why am I always? And I showed the catena rope already, and now again. And then I thought, stupid mind again, dull mind, slow mind. Why am I like this? I should take this as an opportunity to practice. This is just as important of my development as my meditation, is that I approach this sweeping with the right attitude. Because the sweeping is not difficult, even if you have a hurt back, but the mind makes it difficult. When you don't want to do it, that makes it really, really difficult. It's like the story of Ajahn Brahm that you might know, when he had to do much moving earth with wheelbarrows. And another monk saw how Ajahn Brahm was struggling with the same kind of mindset many, many, many years ago. Like, why do we have to do this stupid earth moving? And then the other monk walked up to Ajahn Brahm and said, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. And the same with sweeping the leaves. Sweeping the leaves is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. So then I thought, this broom will be my teacher. Then my mind, crazy mind, went further and said, so now my teacher is not Ajahn Brahm, it's Ajahn Broom. Yeah. Yes, Ajahn Broom. And then I thought, well, that other monk then was also sweeping, what is his teacher then? Ajahn Brumuli. Yes. So Ajahn Brum and Ajahn Brumuli, they taught us a lot. Yes. You can learn a lot from those kind of things in life, not only from your meditation. So I suppose that is sort of the summary of this talk. Practice not only meditation, but take every opportunity in life to develop yourself. The Buddha often spoke about development, bhavana. And sometimes people say, bhavana means meditation. But then they think, no, bhavana is about more than just meditation. It's development of everything we do in life. And especially when our mind throws a tantrum, when it gets angry and annoyed at whatever. You will have your own things. I have my things. That is an opportunity to practice. To go against our minds, against our desires. What the Buddha called to go against the stream. We go against the stream of our minds that have been deluded for a long, long time. And by doing so, we actually move towards happiness and peace, and we let go of our own selfish desires. So by practicing generosity, by listening to Ajahn Brum and Ajahn Brumuli, you can learn a lot. That has actually very deep implications, because by doing something that you don't want to do, but you do it for others, you let go of your sense of self. And the sense of self is the root of all problems in our lives, the Buddha said. So, well, maybe he didn't say it literally like that, but that's the point. That's the basic point of Buddhism. We reduce our sense of self, and the more we reduce our sense of self and ego, the more happiness we get in return. And eventually, what I started my talk with about Nibbana, if you reduce your sense of self to zero, that is Nibbana. So I did talk about deep things anyway, even though I was instructed to talk about the very more, keep it light. But I didn't actually, because this is really, really deep stuff. So I hope these reflections were helpful for you. And at least we had a little laugh at some of our crazy minds. And yeah, that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening. And I really, really appreciate that you are all here just that alone. Thank you. So now we can have some questions, if there are any. If any of you has a question, then please put up your hand or make a noise, and Bill will come to you with the microphone. There's definitely some questions from the internet.
Oh.
Hey, Eddie.
Yeah, Bruce, Sunil, I'll ask a question. Yeah. You know, I like the last part of your talk, you know, when you talk about the...
Only the last part.
But that's a very powerful talk, yeah, about the sweeping and the mind, you know, and you refer to Ajahn Brahm's, you know, the wheelbarrow thing, yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, to help calm yourself, isn't it? Yeah. If the situation is simple, that works. But sometimes the situation, you know, or the phenomena is more severe, you know.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'll just say I just share first, then maybe you can comment, you know. If it's too severe, you can't just let go, isn't it? So I bring in patience, tolerance, and understanding, you know, the Buddha's saying,
yeah,
are the highest virtues everyone should practice.
I see what
and
you're saying.
And impermanence too, you know. That works, okay. Slowly it go down.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. I gave some, maybe you could say, silly examples in a way, because how difficult is it to sweep? Not so bad. But sometimes we are faced with much more difficult situations in life. And then it's not so easy to just accept and be all generous. Yeah. So it's not always that easy. But it's a little bit like, I feel like lifting weights. You don't start lifting weights with 200 kilos the first day. Otherwise, you'll end up like me with a broken back. You start with maybe, I don't know anything about weightlifting, but maybe you start about with 10 kilos. And then you do 20 and 30, and then one day you can do 200. So you start generosity with small acts. And if you feel like doing more and more, then you do more and more. And then you can also face more and more difficult situations in life as you start developing yourself. It's a bit of a short answer, but does that answer what sort of your comment or question, Eddie?
Yes, it does. Can I just add in a little bit more? A little bit?
With what?
Sometimes, if the situation, it's long-lasting, you know, okay? Yeah. So it's, especially for newcomers, you know, it's impossible to stay the Buddhist way, you know, okay? Yeah. So what I mean is, what do you think in that case, if it's too severe, they have to seek medical help, you know, temporarily, till they get better, and then they abandon the medical help this thing and keep practicing again.
Yeah, what if medical help is necessary that doesn't have much to do with what I was aiming at. Yeah, but yeah. If you have heard back, maybe that's what you're saying. If your back is hurting and people say that you have to do work anyway, then sometimes it's good to say no. because I knew, okay, that sweeping, my back isn't that bad. I just pulled a muscle a little bit, so I can do that. But if you're really hurt and people might say, oh, you have to do this work anyway, even though you know it's gonna hurt you, then sometimes you have to stand your ground and not be generous. Eddie, that's a good point, because then you're still generous, but towards yourself, yeah? Because you're like, okay, I can be generous to you or generous to my own back now, and I will say, no, I won't do that. For example, other morning, they asked me to do lifting of wood and put it in the shed. And actually, I did volunteer to do it in a way. But I'd also said, well, maybe I should just clean up the sewing room instead. I didn't really say no, but I sort of was hinting that my back is not yet in the state to do more lifting now. So, and then I said, I'll instead of lifting the wood, I will clean the sewing room. And so then I got to do that instead. So I made me, that was... No, actually not maybe. That was the right decision to make. And I was more generous towards myself at that moment, yeah. That still makes me happy as well, to be generous towards yourself. Don't forget that as well, actually, yeah. That's really, really, Eddie, that is a good point. Because, often we think generosity towards others, but we have to be generous towards yourself just as much. And that's often is actually the more difficult thing to do. Because for some reason, it's just the nature of the mind to be always more critical and demanding of ourselves than of others. What did this American philosopher Thoreau write again? I really like him, but what did he say? Something about that the strongest tyrant is not opinion of others, but our in opinion of ourselves. I'm botching up the quote here. I wish I could do it justice. But do you know it?
No.
Maybe next time, if all the old senior monks are sick and away again, I'll get the opportunity to bring that quote. It's really, really nice. So I'm sorry to disappoint you, but maybe I'll remember it another time. Yeah. So, that was a very good point. Maybe some people from online have some as well. This is from Wolfram from Germany. Wolfram. Isn't that kind of one of the elements or something, Wolfram? No. Maybe only in Dutch it's called that. If there is no ego and no I, what is it that views? This is one of the deep questions. Maybe I should leave this for last. Oh, and the second one is also deep. Okay, what's the third one? I don't even understand that one. It must be deeper than I can go. About the rootless chittas. I really don't. I'm not joking. Okay, and the fourth? I'm going to answer them, don't worry. But I'm thinking which one to start with. So this one is actually, could you explain a bit more, this is from Ollie from England, could you explain a bit more about a process for meditating on generosity? For example, do we use the feeling that arises as the meditation object? Yes, very good question, Ollie. So first of all, you bring up the happiness of the generosity in your mind. We did a little short moment of this when I asked you to reflect upon some generosity acts. So then, but you can make it more official, let's say, when you actually do this as a meditation. We all know about the breath meditation, the metta meditation most of us will know about as well. But this is also one of the meditation subjects in the suttas taught very clearly by the Buddha. So what you do is you have your meditation posture, and or you can do it while walking as well, of course. But you just bring up the joy that comes from generosity, and also just the feeling of that you g- get from giving, because that act of giving, it always brings joy. So then you focus, you could focus on that feeling, or you could just keep remembering all the joyful memories of generosity, and just like a small fire starts with small twigs, and you start tossing up on the fire more bigger twigs, then it starts burning brighter and brighter. So when you start reflecting on generous acts that you did, at first you might be, what did I do? I don't do much generous acts. So you might be struggle to remember something. Maybe even back earlier might struggle to remember something. But once your mind get in that mood of remembering generous things that you did or that others did, yeah, that might work as well, then it creates this kind of feedback loop. It becomes easier and easier to reflect upon, and the feeling of joy starts to increase more and more. And then indeed, Oli, you could, if you want, if this feeling stays stable, even if you are not actively thinking about the acts anymore, if the joy just stays with you, then you could use that as a meditation object itself. You just stay with that joy. And the Buddha called it piti sukha. And he said, what does this lead to? If you focus on that joy, maybe some sutta expert here, what does it lead to? Do you know? What does it lead to if you focus on the joy?
Happiness.
Yeah, but it also leads to the jhanas, he said. This meditation that Oli is asking about leads to the jhanas, the Buddha said. So this is not just some thing that you should shove aside as silly stuff from Sunyo, no. This is really deep stuff. So yeah, you can do that. Focus on the joy, stay with it, and see what happens. Yeah, very good question. Okay, so now I would say, if anybody is happy with what I've said so far and doesn't want to hear about no self and other deep stuff, then be happy to leave for those. Because this was supposed to be light. For those who want to hear about no self and other things that I'll try to answer, then you can stay. I won't look if you leave. So this is from Rolf Ram from Germany. If there is no ego and no I, what is it that feels? What is it that meditates? And what leaves the body when you die and get reborn? How do I know if there is no I? So those I told you those were deep questions. If there is no ego and no I, what is it that feels? It's just feelings. That's it. Why did in the suttas? Why do you call it feelings? Because it feels. It's just feelings existing. And nobody will feel. It's just feelings, that's all. Just you could say the mind knows, but even that is already objectifying it. It's actually just feelings happening and feelings ceasing again. Things in life change all the time. We feel like there's something constant inside of ourselves. There is somebody who feels. That's what we feel like. There's somebody who does our lives. Somebody who is the head honcho in life. Like I am now the head honcho monk for this weekend. We feel like we have a head honcho in life. And that is our ego. Like everything happens to that thing inside of us that we are. We give it a name even. We think that's what we are. But this is all an illusion, funnily enough. Because it is all created by the mind, that sense of self. And it is not actually real. And because it's no I that feels, it's just feelings that happen, and the mind mistakenly thinks that somebody feels. What is it that meditates? It's meditation that meditates. No, it's the same thing. Yeah. It's, you could say it's the mind that meditates, but really, it's just meditation happening. What leaves, I'm sort of answering this quickly because we're already running late time. What leaves the body when you die and gets reborn? The same person, really, that it's not without a self, but even while alive there was no self, but after you die there's still no self. But the mind or the mind still continues on. Yeah. How do I know if there is no I? Well, I can't know if there is no I. Yeah. Once the I disappears, then you know there's no I. I don't know. I don't really feel like this kind of topic to be. Sometimes I really get really into this, but I feel after this talk, I don't want to address it too much. So that I'm really sort of, it feels probably Wolfram that I'm sort of brushing your question aside, but my mind just doesn't want to engage with this subject too much right now. So I hope that sort of answers it anyway. Maybe in another talk one day I will address it more in depth. There's many talks about this on the internet anyway already. Sibel, also from Germany. Dear Arjan, could you explain how a thought is created? Yes, a thought is created because you want it. You want to think. We often feel like when we meditate that the thoughts come into our minds from outside, like they happen despite us or regardless of what we are doing, like we have no choice in the matter. And you will also often hear meditation instructions saying, just let the thoughts come and go. There's nothing you can do about it. But this is not true, because we want to think. We like to think. We like to be restless. We don't want to be peaceful. Really, deep down inside, we are afraid of deep meditations. We are afraid of the silence inside, because we feel like if we stop thinking, that part of us disappears, part of what we thought we were. So now, Wolfram, I am actually getting to your question about no self as well. Because if we stop thinking, we feel like we lose something that is an essential part of us. So we want to keep this alive. We want to keep this thinker alive. And because we want to keep thinking and we like it actually, we enjoy it. That's why a thought is created. That's how I reflect upon it anyway. Ah, this is a comment from Marjolein van Veen, who is my mother. Hi. Everybody's clapping. Mom, I don't know if you can hear it through the microphone. Everybody's clapping. Hello, Sunjo. Hear your mother. She's Dutch. Her English isn't very good. Here is your mother, she means. Here is your mother. Very nice talk. Love you. XXX. Aww. Sadhu, everybody's saying. That means very, very nice. Mom, I love you too. And I'm going to come to you soon because I can't travel again after the COVID restrictions have been lifted. Monks live a very, we love to live isolated lives, but it's also important to meet your family as well. So I'm going to see her very soon. That's the best questions I've ever had. I should just stop there. But there is one more. And don't want to leave anybody out. So this is from Xin Yi from Singapore. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I mean Xin Yi, not Singapore. I know I pronounced Singapore correctly. About the rootless citta, ahetuka citta, arising from hearing, smell, etc. How do the things we hear, smell, result from karma? For example, walking past a smelly bin is bad karma. walking past the smelly bin, it means you either have to knock on your neighbor's door or throw out your own bin. I don't know, but I don't know what rootless jitters are, actually. I never heard of that. Maybe that's an Abhidhamma idea, because it sounds like it a bit, because I like to think that I know the suttas pretty well. I don't know. But I never heard of this before, so it must be some later idea. So how do the things we hear smell result from karma? I can answer that, though. The things we hear and smell result from karma because we were born because of karma. And the very fact that you are hearing my voice right now is a result of you being born as a human who can hear other humans. That's how what you hear and smell result from karma. And that is the karma that really matters. Because when we are born, that is when we set in motion all the rest of life. And that is really the cause of suffering, really, when you're born. That's when all the other suffering follows. And compared to being born afterwards, all the suffering is just sort of more like fluctuations in suffering. The big thing happens when you get born. So I hope that makes some sense. For example, is walking past the smelly bin is bad karma? No. Because, as I said, being born is really what matters when it comes to karma. And walking past the smelly bin is just walking past the smelly bin. There's nothing more to it. There is deeper ideas behind it, Xinyi, because I know what you're sort of asking, because sometimes people think that everything good or bad in life happens because of karma, but that is not what the Buddha said. Yeah. Sometimes bad things happen to us just because we were unlucky. Yeah. Smelly bin is not such a big problem, but you might get abused or hurt or whatever, and then that is being unlucky, being with the wrong people, not something because of bad karma. So it's not your fault when those kind of things happen. So not everything in life is due to bad karma. And that's good to remember, because otherwise we start blaming ourselves for everything that happens in life to us. And there's many things we can't do anything about. You get sick, for example. The Buddha said there's many, many causes for sickness. And one of them is indeed karma. But he listed a whole variety of causes of sickness. But only one is bad karma. So also many other reasons you get sick that have nothing to do with your own acts in the past. It's just, well, it does in a sense that I mentioned earlier, you were born a human, so now you have the bad situation that you can get sick. But it's not that like, oh, you got a specific sickness, you get, a cancer here because you punch somebody here in a past life. I don't think it works like that. And the Buddha also said it doesn't work like that, because you just get a cancer here because you were born a human. That is most of the time the case. Yeah. Okay. Well, that was the last question. Thanks for all the questions and thanks for your attention again.
Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.
So let's now pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. And we always do that as monks, by the way. We do that with our shoulder uncovered from the robe. So I have to change now. There we go. Or Venerable is wearing his jacket. That's fine as well.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivandemi. Swagato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami. Supatipanno Bhagavato Savagasangho Sangham Namami.
Thank you for allowing me the generosity to give a talk. I mean, the opportunity for me to be generous to give a talk.
Thank you.
Hello.